The United American Network presents Riverside Rank and File, the voice of labor for Riverside County, California, a podcast for working people by working people. Your host is labor advocate Steve Matthews. Here, the rank and file speak out on jobs, justice, and dignity at work. Now, here's Steve.
Hello, welcome to Riverside Rank and File, the voice of workers and labor in Riverside County. Today, we're very pleased to share with you our guest, Amalia Daslan, who has a lifetime of advocacy and still is advocating, and to share with us her story of how she found her voice and spoke up for people. Amalia, can you explain to us a little bit how you came to the United States in your first period of time here?
Well, yeah, the introduction was when I was 10. My dad was a cook and had been a bracero in this area. Bracero were the workers who would come just seasonal, and then they would go back. There's still fights about the fact that they were underpaid, but, you know, who's going to pay? Anyways, our first home was in Thermal, and it didn't have windows. And so my mom used to put blankets in the windows. It was so cold. She started working in a field that was across the street, and it was a cotton field. And so after school, we would come down and help my mom and start working. Eventually, we ended up going traveling to Northern California, and we became migrant workers.
So were there different crops, depending on where you were sent?
Whatever we could find. We had a little station wagon. It was old. And it was interesting because people say, what would you do? And I say, well, everything we owned was in that station wagon because we could not, and my parents could not afford to leave, have a rental place or anything like that. So we didn't have very much.
So in addition to your parents and you, were you have any siblings that were with you?
There were usually like seven of us that would travel in that station wagon. And we would end up in Marysville or Yuba City. In Marysville, it was the prune season. But we would pick whatever was available at that time. We were always late for school because school started, you know, in September, and yet we were still picking, you know, vegetables or tomatoes and Gilroy. And so when I turned 17, I dropped out of school when I was almost 15.
But you've already been picking vegetables before that time, right?
Oh, all the time, yeah.
How old were you when you started having to pick vegetables?
10.
You were 10, as soon as you came?
Yeah, no, that was 10. But a full-time farm worker, because my parents were afraid of the war in Vietnam, that my brothers, older brothers, would be drafted. I was the youngest of seven. I decided that I would drop out of school, and so that we could still have an income and I could drive my parents. So at 16, I was driving throughout California.
You were driving?
Yeah.
With the seven people in the station
wagon.
Well,
especially when my brothers would come back for school, my two or three brothers who were still in school. And so I was working in the fields in different areas. We would come back. And once the grape season ended, that's when we would travel. What we did is that I started working, and there was a time that I met this Canadian when I was back in California, and I mean in the Coachella Valley, and he was organizing to help Robert Kennedy.
And so when he ran for president?
He was running for president. He was going to be here in L.A. And for some reason, I heard of him, and he invited me to go and volunteer in my phone calls. So that's what I did. And it was surprising to me when the next day I found out that he had been shot. And Dolores Huerta, who became my mentor afterwards, was there. And so my life was farm working, Once we found out that the United Farm Workers was coming, and that they needed people to know what was going on.
We're coming to unionize you?
To unionize us and to be in the Coachella Valley. I went to a couple of the meetings. I met Dolores Huerta, Cesar Chavez, and then Larry Itleon, who was the president, and Pete Velasco, the vice president of the Filipino organization, that were the first ones to come out and strike.
So let's take a step here, because I don't think many people necessarily know that the Filipinos were very active in the farm workers, maybe Mexican-American folks that were from this area. Yeah. But I don't think a lot of people know that.
No, and that was something that I made sure that in the assembly they heard. I talked to some of the representatives once I was back and I had gone to the whole system, that we give them representation. To me, it became a battle cry to say, "Sí se puede," yes, we can. And so the day came when we were supposed to walk out on strike. And I kept thinking about Dolores and the fact that she has said, sí se puede, yes, it can be done, yes, we can. And so I walked out on strike. At the end of the day, they selected me to be the president of the striking committee at 17.
At 17, you're the president. You had already reached out to the Filipino workers.
Oh, they knew me. They knew me, and during the strike, we tried to organize. And as you know, that the history of the Filipino workers here, they were not allowed to bring the women with them. And so the growers would sell them food or, you know, different things. A lot of them were older. And one day I wanted to test that situation. And so I walked into their living quarters with a lot of the security guards and dogs. And
not happy that you were there. The Filipino workers were happy with it, but not
the Filipinos, because I helped them with their food and washing dishes, but at the same time I was talking to them about the fact that why they needed to come out and strike and support us and to form the union. And so I realized was that there were the sheriffs that were coming in, and we knew that the people could get violent too. And so what I did is to walk out, sit on the ground, and then Pete Velasco who was the vice president of the Filipino organization, and another worker came out, and we held hands and we started singing "We Shall Overcome." Mm-hmm. When they picked me up and threw me in the car, the Filipinos walked out, all the workers
there. They walked out when you were treated that way?
When I was treated that way. And so, the United Farm Workers waited for me to turn 18 because we had no idea of the pesticides that they were using in the fields.
And they were affecting the workers' health.
Oh, my God, yeah. I had a lot of allergies, a lot of scratching on my eyes, I would see, sometimes it would be spraying next to where we were working. I got to see a lot of the women with kids, you know, remember during the grape season, it's May, June, and kids were in the cars. There were no toilets. We had no access to whatever we carried in a little canteen. Mm-hmm. That's the water that we had to drink. And so that was some of the issues that we were fighting for. And so I lost the case. And when we sued the county of Riverside, but when we were getting ready for the appeal.
For the use of the pesticides, is that the issue?
Yeah. Yeah. And when we were getting ready for the appeal, they decided to open the files that they had. We did know, and the life expectancy of farm workers was very short.
The hard work and the pesticides.
The fact that it's so hot and that it's so heavy. I used to work with my mom when I was working, and you had to carry the boxes once they're full all the way to the end of where you were working, and they were pretty heavy. So what I did is I would carry mine and my mom's, because I didn't want my mom to be carrying that. And it was very difficult, and the life, like I said, the life expectancy was very low, and the conditions. I remember what our community, our Mexican community, always tries to make a joke and have fun and laugh at different things. And I remember that one of the workers someplace said a joke, and we started laughing, all of us, we could hear. And the grower came to us and said, "Take this job serious. You're not supposed to be laughing."
You're not supposed to be laughing, okay. You can do all the hard work that you have, and you can have the pesticides, you can have all the problems, but you can't laugh.
Please don't laugh. This is serious business. Yeah. So that was part of a lot of the things that we were able to do, educate our community. My exposure to Dolores Huerta, who was the co-founder, and I keep reminding people, she was the co-founder. Now we think Cesar Chavez all the time. Yep. I said Dolores was the co-founder too. Yep. And for me, as a young Mexican, the fact that I could see someone that looked like me, she trusted me. I still communicate with Dolores. We still,
and she's 95, is it?
Yes.
And she's still active?
Yes. And every time I say, "Dolores, I'm getting tired. I want to do more things." And she goes, "Yeah, I just wait till you hear my age."
So when they named you the president of the strike committee, you had already been working to unify people, the Filipino, the Mexican,
well,
American
the
workers.
Well, the Filipinos came at the same time that the United Farm Workers came. But it was, that's when I got to know them. Larry Itleong liked me a lot and told my parents, "If you want to send her to school, I will help pay for her education." And my dad said, "No, how can we send her far?" It's like, and so I got to know them and feel so close, because I was young and I felt the protection of all of them.
But all these even older workers, you became the person that was the head of the strike committee that united people.
So, well, yeah, and now I think, why did they select me? It's like I was so young.
And who was it that selected you?
Some of the workers who were there, and it was recommended by the United Farm Workers. I guess they felt that being young and not being afraid, the media was going to follow me. Now I see, because I'm so involved in politics, that's why you guys chose me, right? But it was the fact that I was not afraid. And when you're young, you're not that afraid. You know, even when I had a security guard, they had put a knife in my face and said, "If you say huelga again, we're going to cut your face." Oof. And I kind of started yelling huelga, like, now I would have said, "Okay, I'll talk later."
Are they basically threatening your life?
Absolutely. But there was a Latino father who was walking out with a box of grapes, and he threw the box of grapes. He called his daughters to come out, and he said, "Let's get the heck out of here." Yeah. He used other words, but he stopped it, mm-hmm. right?
And stopped the threat against you.
The threat, and to me, a young woman, I kept yelling "Huelga," right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And so now I would think about it. But I made a presentation in front of a group that I have now that helped organize, which is Democratic Women of the Desert. And I said, I was watching the television and I saw this older man who was crying. He was selling popsicles. And I took him and roughed him up, and he started crying. And I cried with him. But then I remember that time that another older man helped me, and that I would never know his name, and I never would know the name of both. And it made me feel sad because I could not give him a hug. I could never say, I'm so sorry that this is going on. But that was, you know, United Farm Workers.
You're like 17. You did tell me another part of the story that I want to make sure everyone hears, that you had never been on a plane. You had never gone out of the country.
No.
And you were asked to do what?
The United Auto Workers of Canada came down to give support to the workers here. And eventually they were going to have a conference in Port Elgin in Canada. And so they contacted the United Farm Workers, and they invited me as a guest. And so I didn't know. I've never traveled on a plane. My mother invited Father Mark Day, who was the priest of the United Farm Workers. This priest used to go into the fields and pray for the soul of the scab workers who were breaking the...
trying to break the strike.
Yeah. They went to L.A. with me.
To LAX, to the airport.
And so my mom wanted him to give me a blessing before I boarded the plane. I had absolutely no idea where I was going or where Port Elgin was. I have...
In Canada, okay.
And so they picked me up as someone who was working for the boycott, and they drove me over there. And I thought I was going to go and sit down and listen to whatever they had to say, right? So as I get there, I enter the room and they say, oh, she's here. And so I'm looking around like, okay, I'm here. And then they start partying so that I could go to the podium, right?
And how many people more or less were there?
I would say at least 150 or something.
And
like
other than the farm workers that you represented, was this like the first big thing that you had to speak in front of?
Yeah.
And you're how old?
I'm 17.
17
and a half.
At that time.
Yeah. And so they start clapping, the union clap, you know, and then they take me to the podium, and I had no education. I had never, the only thing that I knew was to talk about, you know, the strike and talk to the workers, but never in a situation where you're exposed to people that are organizers. And I felt threatened. But at the same time, I just talked about the conditions of the fields, and that was that. My speech must have been like 5 minutes or so. I can't even remember, but it was scary.
You had a truth to tell, and you told it, even if it was in another country, even if it was the first time you ever was on a plane.
Right, and so Dennis McDermott was the president of the union. And he gave me a little, I still have it. It's kind of like the flag of Canada in silver. And behind he put Viva la Causa, Dennis McDermott. And so that was kind of nice. And they gave me money for my expenses, but I gave the money back to the United Farm Workers because I was so, like, I just wanted to help as much as I could. But that was the beginning of my life in terms of the organization and having people around me who were interested in making a better life for themselves.
So you had a hand in that, but your life also then transformed. You went back to school.
I eventually went back to school. I decided to go to Mexicali, live in Mexicali, because there was a little house that we had, my parents had bought, and so that I didn't have to pay for that. I didn't have a car, so to go from Mexicali to Imperial County to IBC, I needed a ride. And there were a couple of occasions that that I didn't make it on time, or people had already left or not coming. And so the border patrol, there were a couple of them, they would give me a ride in their motorcycle to the college.
Okay.
That's when you're young, and, you know. Yeah. And so that's how I would get to IVC. From there, with no the lack of college education, I mean high school education or formal education in so many ways, I transferred to San Diego State University, and eventually I did get my teaching credential, and I went for a master's in education, and came back to the Coachella Valley. But during that time, it was kind of like my understanding. In terms of the exposure to life, I only knew the life of farm workers. I only knew what my family was, what Mexicans did. The Filipino organization really, really helped me. And I still remember Pete and Larry Leong and the people that came to help.
So your own family has benefited by all the struggle that you've gone through and your willingness to sacrifice for other people. Why don't you, if you could, share a little bit of your children, what they're doing.
Well, what I tell people now, because I got involved in a lot of things, and I have raised a lot of money for candidates, I have raised a lot of money for scholarships. My oldest daughter is an attorney, and she's really good in terms of with her husband, how to make money, but they're good. But they also march with me whenever there's a need, and they help a lot of the candidates. My second daughter received her master's in economics, and she helps corporations get permits from the cities for environmental groups. And then my son, he lives here. And he also became a businessman, and he has a lot of programs where they do bring speakers from different parts of the United States to talk about how they succeeded and the difference. So we all march, we all put our caps and tennis shoes and go and support. And right now it's been crazy, but we're doing as much as we can. I'm doing as much as I can to help our community that has been hunted like animals, right. And it hurts. It really hurts my soul to see what's happening here in this country and what poor people that are the workers of this area and the workers that want to have a better living. You know, but there was an incident that also made me change my views.
Okay, what was that?
I was a farm worker, and there was a march that we had from Coachella to Calexico, and it was in the summer. We get there and we have blisters, and I was able to pick up Ralph Abernathy and march with him. He marched with the farm workers.
Abernathy?
Yeah, successor of Martin Luther King. And when we got to Calexico, we were marching, and then we were in front of the Safeway, and we wanted to, they said, let's pray for the soul of the people that own this corporation so that they can help us in boycott. And so, okay, we got on our knees, like all of us. And then I turned around and I saw my brother who was holding a flag. And I kept saying, kneel down. And he kept saying, no, kneel down. And I could see that he was like angry, but also in pain.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went and I asked
long, him, long march in 100 plus degree weather, probably, in pain.
I asked him, and I said, why didn't you want to get on your knees? And he said, after we have marched, after we have been under the sun and the dirt and everything, I do not want to see my people on their knees. And I went, whoa. Mm-hmm.
Revelation.
Revelation. The militant in me started coming out too. It was not this, we're all brothers and sisters and I'm, you know, we love each other, but how do we learn to fight? How do we learn to make this a better situation for us? Not always getting on our knees, but demanding what is rightfully ours.
Rightfully to be treated with dignity.
Right. Human rights became very important. I've been in the Martin Luther King Committee for 38 years now. I marched for gay rights when it was founded here. I was the first woman that was not gay to be part of that. And so human rights became really good in terms of how I felt that life should be. Mm-hmm. And I think that during that particular period and that incident kind of like made me realize that he was right.
Yeah.
Even though we might be poor, we have dignity and we have pride, and we should never abandon those things.
You understand where he was coming from and
absolutely
why that angle was there. So. Yeah, the wonderful thing is you still have the life of advocacy continues, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
What would you say to people that still haven't found their voice? Like, you found your voice, you were in service to people, to farm workers, to the whole community, and still are. What would you say to people that could find their voice? And we certainly would invite those folks here to have a podcast to be able to share that voice. What would you say to them to encourage other people, young people, people that have not used their voice, but you know that they would if they were given the opportunity? What would you say?
I think that it's becoming there's more of us that have received an education, right? And so when I started working in terms of organizing, I felt that, okay, what is it that I can do I cannot be in the different organizations that they're asking me to participate. I have to do something that it really expands, right? And that's when I started getting involved in politics, because I felt that it's so difficult to change laws, but if you select people that have the view of life and humanity and equal rights, and that if we help them get into those positions of power, there's more voices, right? And so what I do also is I participate and speak to a lot of groups of young people. On the board of Democratic Women on the Desert, we have young girls. So mm-hmm. that they can learn from us. I have encouraged, you know, them to run for office. The only way we change a system is a way of us being like what they say, you know. It's either you're at the table or you're the menu. And so if we're not at the mm-hmm. table, we cannot ask for certain things. And so that's, to me, an important part of what we're doing.
So I would ask you to come back to continue this story at other times on the podcast. And it's been an amazing journey that you're still on. Really, thank you for your service.
Well,
and
thank
respect you a lot.
Thank you
so much. So this is Riverside Rank and File, and we appreciate your participation in listening to this amazing life story. Thank you so much.
Riverside Rank and File is a production of the United America Network. This program is available from unitedamericanetwork.com and distribution partners, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Captivate.fm, and YouTube. Join us again next week for another episode discussing important labor issues from Riverside County, California. Rank and file.